That's session number 12371, reel 12.
Which in the circumstances in which we found ourselves was not very pleasant. It seemed to take hours for us to get to the shore, but then all of a sudden there was a great grinding noise and the front part of the landing craft went down with a great crash and a splash, whereupon the first two or three soldiers rushed out the front and disappeared into, clearly, water that was far too deep for them. What happened to them, I don't know. Anyway, eventually the craft grounded and the soldiers started to pour out, and we had no option but to follow them. And before you could say Jack Robinson, we were in the water up to our chests, our fancy battle dresses not being suited for this sort of thing. We waded ashore, and we had scarcely got onto the beach when an army colonel came up to us and said, "Dig yourself a slit trench." We set about doing something that we weren't particularly professional at. I might add that I heard that shortly after this unfortunate colonel was run over by a tank and killed. Well, we saw what D-Day was going to be like at fairly close quarters on that particular morning, and I might say it was the last time that either of us ever volunteered to go on such an operation again. The other interesting episode that happened while I was at 13 Group Headquarters was that, as I said earlier, the group was completely denuded of its squadrons, and we just had one squadron up at Castletown, which was some way to the north. But the Germans were still doing a certain amount of reconnaissance in the area, and whilst they were plotted while they were over the sea, difficulty was found in plotting them once they got over the land at low level. They would get in amongst the hills and it was very difficult to maintain a plot on them. Our communication flight, which was about 20 minutes drive from the headquarters on an airfield called Longmans, which is now a housing estate, our communication flight comprised a variety of different types of aircraft, but it included a Spitfire II. One evening, it was broad daylight, we were sitting outside the mess, which was a private house, when a Ju-88 suddenly appeared at about 50 feet and circled round us two or three times and then disappeared. We were so incensed by this that those of us who were Spitfire trained organised ourselves into a sort of readiness section to dash down to Longmans and leap into the Spitfire too, with the object of trying to intercept one of these aircraft if it tried to do the same thing again. Well, of course, it was a rather futile effort, because once the aircraft, as I say, had crossed the coast, it was no longer being plotted, and it was always going to be a hit-and-miss affair. But directly the ops room reported one of these aircraft heading towards the Scottish east coast from the sea. The one of us who happened to be on readiness duty at that time jumped into the car, raced down to Longmans, which I say it was nearly 20 minutes drive, jumped into the Spitfire II, and then set off on a rather fruitless search operation, which was entirely without any aids at all. None of these sorties had any success, although one day one of these aircraft did fly into a hillside. I can't believe that it could have been anything to do with our activities at all. The only other two interesting things that happened while I was in Scotland was that Sir Stafford and Lady Cripps came on a visit. I'm not sure that he wasn't Minister of Defence at the time. He was certainly a minister. And I was appointed to fly them round Scotland in one of our Rapids. The other small, perhaps interesting episode was that Scotland during the war was not short of food. It was a place where you could always get a good meal. And whenever we had a party in the mess, people were dispatched in the communication aircraft to various parts of Scotland to collect food in order to provide a buffet for our party. Well, on one occasion, I was to go up to Castletown, which, as I say, is not far from John O'Groats, where I was ostensibly supposed to be making a staff visit, but in reality was meant to pick up 10 dozen eggs and a sheep, a dead sheep, I might add. I went up in an Oxford, which was a twin-engine training aircraft. Now, normally, bearing in mind that we were flying at comparatively low levels, 2,000 and 3,000 feet in these aircraft, normally, when we flew up there during the day, there was considerable turbulence over the high ground, and so we often used to fly up along the coast, which reduced the turbulence, and then turn into Wick or Castletown, whichever airfield we were going to. And this I had done when flying up to Castletown. I finished my so-called staff visit. I returned to my aircraft to find all the eggs in an enormous cardboard box, all loose, and a dead sheep. And when I say a dead sheep, I simply mean a dead sheep. It was just lying there with all its wool on and everything. So some airmen loaded the sheep and the big box with all these loose eggs in it in the back of the Oxford. And I was just about to get in to start up when two sailors came running up, all dressed in their square rig, having come over from Orkney, Scarpa Flow. And one of them said to me, would I mind giving them a lift to Inverness as they were going on leave and they would be able to catch the train south? So I said, no, by all means, in you hop. So one of them sat in the front with me in the other seat that was in the front of the Oxford, and the other one sat on the big spar that went through the Oxford just behind the pilot's seat. There were no seats in the back of these Oxfords. It was just this big main spar, and then behind that was a sort of well where the sheep and the eggs were, and then, of course, the door for getting in and out. Well, as evening was approaching, I decided that I was going to go back on the direct route overland, because by this time the turbulence will have died down. So we took off. I climbed to about 3,000 feet. It was a lovely late afternoon with very clear visibility, and the scene was absolutely marvellous. There was not a sign of any turbulence. The aircraft was as steady as a rock. I hadn't even bothered to strap myself in. And I was sitting there, flying along with one finger on top of the control column. Sailor sitting in the seat by the side of me, and the other one sitting on the spar behind, when all of a sudden we hit the most colossal bump. The aircraft suddenly went down. As I wasn't strapped in, I went up and hit my head on the roof. And by the time I came down and back into my seat and was able to get the aircraft back under control again and straighten it out, I looked round to make sure all was well, and there was a sailor in the back, covered in eggs, struggling to get himself out from underneath this dead sheep. Well, anyway, we got back to Inverness and we had to clean him off. We'd lost most of our eggs, but we still had the sheep. Soon after this, I was promoted to wing commander and posted south, where I was to form the 2nd Tempest Wing. The 1st Tempest Wing had already been formed by Bob Beamont, who of course was notable for the fact that he had been a test pilot with Hawkers during one of his rest periods and had done much to bring the Typhoon into service, and then during a second rest period where he'd been a test pilot again with Hawkers, he'd done much to bring the Tempest into service. And so it was right that he should have the 1st Tempest Wing, which he had formed at Newchurch, which is on the Romney Marshes, and was just a field. His wing being known as 150 Wing, and was one of the first mobile wings that were to become so much a part of 2nd Tactical Air Force when the invasion took place. However, at this particular time, he was principally engaged with the battle against the V1. Although he did have sufficient capacity to enable him to carry out supporting fighter operations to help the operations that were going on the Normandy beaches. 150 Wing were attacking airfields that were further inland and therefore keeping down the German fighter force. To get me back into operations, I was attached to 150 Wing as a supernumerary wing commander. And so I took part in the operations against the V1 and one or two of these ramrod operations against German fighter airfields. I won't talk about the V1 operations because I'm quite sure that Bob Beamont, who was after all was the architect of the defence against the V1, I'm quite sure he has recorded in great detail all that everybody needs to know about these particular types of operations. I will just mention one incident that occurred to me during this period at New Church. As I said, New Church was just a field in which we had laid some Sommerfeld tracking, which was a wire runway. And all the accommodation was in tents. These V1s came in at an average height of around about 3,000 feet, but you always got the odd rogue aircraft that either came in higher or came in lower. And one day, I was sitting with three or four other pilots waiting to go on patrol. Behind us was a wooden hut of about 12 feet long and about 6 or 7 feet high, which was part of the farm on which this airfield was situated. I was smoking my pipe, and all was peaceful, when all of a sudden, we saw one of these V1s coming straight at us, looking as if it was flying about 5 feet off the ground. Well, in the brief moment that was going to pass, we all had exactly the same thought, and that was it was our end, because if it didn't hit us, it was going to hit this wooden hut behind us. We threw ourselves on the ground, during which time my pipe disappeared almost entirely down my throat. And when the V1 passed over us, the noise was absolutely shattering. But of course it was much higher than it had first appeared. It was probably nearer to 30 feet than 5 feet. And in fact, it missed the hut behind us. When we all realised we were still alive, we leapt to our feet and looked towards the direction in which the V1 had gone. And there it was, heading for the hills just to the west of Ashford. And sure enough, it disappeared between a sort of revetment between two hills, and as far as I know, it probably reached London. My tour with number 150 wing was very short, and I carried out very few operations, but sufficient, as I say, to get me back into operational good nick in time. I might say at this point that it was quite extraordinary how quickly one slowed down when one stopped operating. And when one returned to operations, it was a very dangerous time, particularly for the experienced pilot, because he was not as quick as he'd been when he had ceased operations, and it took a little time for him to get his pace back to an operational level. And it was during this time that some quite experienced operational pilots were lost. But I was lucky. I was able to get back into operational status pretty quickly. And it was then that I went back to Manston and formed the 2nd Tempest Wing. Now, this was a wing within what used to be known as Fighter Command, which was now called ADGB, and therefore was not a numbered mobile wing. It was the Manston Wing. And it comprised 3 Tempest squadrons, number 80 and number 274, and number 501 squadron. 501 squadron was an unusual squadron because it was in fact a night Tempest squadron. difficulty had been found by the mosquitoes in catching the V1 because of the short time that one had available to one, bearing in mind that one couldn't start chasing them until they'd gone through the gun belt, which left roughly 75 miles to catch a target that was already travelling at close on 350 miles an hour. And so the mosquitoes were having difficulty in catching these targets, and so as an experiment, they'd taken a number of night fighter pilots and formed this Tempest squadron. The CO of the squadron was in fact the pilot who shot down more V1s than any other pilot during the V1 campaign. He was a very unlikely sort of hero, inasmuch he looked exactly what he was, because before the war, I believe he'd been a rent collector, and that's exactly what he looked like. He used to wear his hat absolutely flat on top of his head, when most fighter pilots had their hats at a jaunty angle. But he was a very, very successful operator. It is perhaps unfortunate that when the V1 started to decline, and therefore the operations against them declined as well, that he tried to persuade me to take his night fighter Tempest squadron on the various day operations in which my other two squadrons were involved. And I refused to do this because his pilots, neither he nor his pilots, were trained in day operations, which were entirely different to the type of operations in which he himself and his squadron had been engaged.
Do you remember this man's name?
I'll tell you when I can remember it.
Right.
Subsequently, when we moved over to the continent, I left 501 squadron behind for the reasons I've just explained. They were not a day fighter squadron. And he, once I was gone, he persuaded either the station commander or the new wing leader, I don't know who, to allow him to go on day operations. With the result, he was shot down. The operations that the Manston Tempest Wing carried out were escorting bombers, carrying out sweeps, attacking enemy airfields, and this type of operation. However, there were three particular operations that might be worthy of mention. One day I was told that the Germans had just landed a fighter wing at Leeuwarden, which is an airfield up in the north of Holland, about 175 miles from Manston. And I was told to get off as quickly as possible and attack them before they could refuel and get off the ground again. Well, this required us to carry long-range tanks. And one thing was absolutely vital when you were carrying long-range tanks, and that was you dropped them if you got involved in combat, and you certainly dropped them before you attacked a ground target. Because if you were hit in a long-range tank, your whole aeroplane would go up in a big conflagration. So I took off with number 80 and 274 squadron, 16 aircraft. We were in those days flying in eights per squadron and not 12s. It was a much more manoeuvrable formation. And moreover, with the tempest, it was even better, a better formation with the high cruising speeds that we were able to achieve. We flew up to North Holland. It was a nice sunny day. We were flying at about 15,000 feet, and I picked up Leeuwarden quite some distance out. I positioned the wing to get ready to launch the attack. I ordered them to drop their tanks, and then we carried out the attack. I was leading the front squadron. We dived down. We approached the airfield at 0 feet. I was clocking over 450 miles an hour, and certainly the squadron that I was leading weren't lagging behind. We crossed the boundary fence and fired at targets that were immediately in front of us. Aircraft, Bowsers, other support vehicles. And immediately I was followed by my second squadron. There was very heavy anti-aircraft fire. And we then climbed up and left the target area. It's perhaps interesting to know that every single aircraft of those 16 was hit by anti-aircraft fire, some worse than others. As we left the target area, one of my pilots called up and said that his oil pressure was dropping quickly. Now, with the Sabre engine, this was fatal. It was a very high revving engine, and lack of oil pressure meant that the engine was going to seize up very quickly. Well, we were up in North Holland. The only advice I could offer this chap was to leave the formation and to fly as far south as he could, as far as he could get, in the vain hope that with any luck he might be able to get far enough south to get behind the advancing Allied lines, which were now down in northern France somewhere. But he opted to stay with the formation. We had something like a 175-mile leg over the sea to get back to Manston. And I didn't think there was any hope of him making it. But interestingly, it wasn't until we were approaching the English coast that he said he was going to ditch, because his engine was now giving him so much trouble that he would prefer to ditch with the help of a little bit of engine power than to perhaps ditch without any engine power at all. Both the Typhoon and the Tempest, with their very big air intakes, of course, were very nasty aircraft to ditch, because directly you touch the water, the air intake acted as an immediate brake and the aircraft invariably turned over on its back. This chap, by opting to ditch with the aid of a bit of engine, at least gave himself a better chance of surviving. And in fact, he did survive. We were able to, of course, warn the air sea rescue people, who were operating out of Ramsgate anyway, that he was about to ditch, and he got down successfully and was picked up very quickly. But